Earlier this year, the U.S. Geological Service detailed what exactly it found in wastewater left over from fracking natural gas and oil. Treating and disposing of the huge amounts of noxious wastewater that result from frack wells depends on a proper analysis of the water, and a few months ago, Reed Frazier of the public radio program The Allegheny Front checked in on the scientists hard at work to figure this out.
Denise Acob is a microbiologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. In a USGS lab outside of Washington, D.C., she holds up a glass jar filled with water. At the bottom of the jar is what looks like sand.
And so it's got this kind of brown color, it's rocky, the water's still really clear.
The sediment is from a clean stream bed. It's been inside the bottle for 90 days. Acob holds up a second bottle. This one's not so clear. Inside of it is sand from a stream in West Virginia that was polluted by a leaking oil and gas wastewater impoundment.
You'll actually can't even see through the bottle.
An orange goo coats the sides of the second bottle. The goo is iron oxide.
The less EPA is going to have to go back and sort of redo some of the work.
So what are the implications of the court's decision that only so-called direct benefits can be considered? How might this influence the case for implementing EPA's power plant rules regarding carbon dioxide, for example?
Well, I think EPA's ability to regulate carbon pollution from power plants, it's a different section than the section of the law that the Supreme Court looked at with regards to mercury. But it is true that when you regulate one pollutant, you require a scrubber or some technology to be put on a smokestack, you frequently get reduction in other pollutants. That's good news. And in this case, there were significant fine particle reductions in addition to the mercury reductions. And the court seems to be suggesting that you can't count those benefits. I think in the case of carbon pollution, the consequences, the cost to our health, to our environment of carbon pollution are so high that any sort of cost-benefit analysis should be fine.
What's the mood inside the EPA and the White House in response to this ruling, do you think?
Well, I think the EPA, the White House, the Justice Department, obviously disappointed. This was a hugely important case from their perspective. The Solicitor General actually argued the case. It's good news that it's a very narrow decision. It simply says, EPA, yes, you looked at cost, but you should have looked at it earlier in the decision-making process. Under this statute, this section of the Clean Air Act, there's sort of a two-step process. First, you look at the science, mercury, is it dangerous to people? How dangerous is it? And then what EPA did is looked at all the power plants that emit mercury, and there are many different types of power plants on sort of a type-by-type basis, set standards based on how much it would cost. And in some instances, they said, you're not going to have to do anything because it's not cost effective. So they did look at cost. They looked at it endlessly. What Scalia and the majority are saying is you should have looked at cost in the first decision, in the science decision.
You know, this decision reminds me of a scene from that Greek myth, the myth of Sisyphus. You know, the guy is trying to roll this rock all the way up the hill and just gets to the top and it goes back. The U.S. government's been trying to regulate mercury since you were running the EPA back during the Clinton administration. What's going on here?
It's been a long road, the efforts to regulate mercury. We were focused on smaller sources. That's the way the law works. You start with the smaller, you know, incinerators and work your way up to the largest, which are the power plants. And the Bush administration could have easily continued the work I had begun. They chose not to follow the path. They lost in court. And then the Obama administration, Lisa Jackson, came back and said, okay, we're going to go back to sort of where Browner was and move forward. It's been a lot of time. And I think that's extremely unfortunate. But I think it's also the testament to how complicated and thoughtful these decisions are.
While you were EPA administrator, you took pretty tough actions to limit air pollution from smog and particulates. What were the legal challenges to getting those rules passed, and how did the EPA go about quantifying costs and benefits back then, especially indirect benefits?
Well, interestingly, Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion on mercury, also wrote a majority opinion reviewing the pollution standards that I set, the soot and smog standards. And in that case, it was a 9-0 ruling. And he agreed with our argument that we didn't have to take cost into effect in setting these ambient air quality standards because what Congress had told us to do was set a public health standard based on the best available science. Now, it's a different section of the law, but obviously it was a very important win for EPA because industry argued, no, you should be setting it based on how much it's going to cost us to reduce our pollution and whether the benefits of cleaner air exceed those costs to industry. And in that case, the court said, no, you know, they've done it the right way. In this case, they're saying, yes, you looked at costs, but you should have looked at it earlier in the process. And I think the concern we should all have is that if we move towards setting environmental pollution standards, workplace safety, whatever, car safety on a cost-benefit analysis, we may not get the kind of important science-based standards that have brought us safety and cleaner air and cleaner water. Because when you look at costs before you actually regulate a pollutant, for example, you're guessing what the technology is going to be. And the costs inevitably are higher in those studies than they turn out to be once the standard is set, because American innovation and ingenuity find a cheaper solution.
What are the next steps that the EPA will be taking to implement a mercury emissions rule, given industry's propensity to say it's going to cost too much?
Well, I think this case is very interesting because when EPA goes back to the rule, there will be objective cost numbers available because so many plants are already complying with the mercury requirements. So here they're going to have very realistic numbers. That is not a usual turn of events, obviously.
And by the way, what is the status of this rule today? If I were running a power plant, do I have to limit mercury or not while this legal wrangling continues?
So some states separately have mercury requirements in place. And so those would obviously continue. And a number of plants have shut down in anticipation of these requirements. So the actual consequence of this may be small, but my sense is EPA will move quickly to fix the situation.
Carol Browner was the EPA administrator during President Clinton's term and former assistant to President Obama for energy and climate change. She now chairs the League of Conservation Voters. Thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
Thank you.
And there's a discussion with Vermont law professor Pat Parento on the legal issues of the Supreme Court decision and its implications at our website, loe.org.